The basic idea of this workshop is to introduce the local residents, the PI residents, to some recent developments in basically extensions of tensor network techniques to quantum field theories. And what I'll do this first hour is describe a little bit what we're going to see during the next 2 days and also introduce you to the subject slowly. So today is Monday. We'll be looking at matrix product states and PEPs. These are specific tensor networks. And we'll start with an introduction. That's what I'm going to be doing next. And this morning, we'll look at matrix product states and PEPs on a lattice system. So not yet on for quantum field theories. The idea here is to illustrate in which sense these tools are useful by showing you some of the most important results obtained so far on the lattice. In particular, Philippe Corboz will tell us about applications to simulating fermions on a two-dimensional lattice. And then Sheng Gu will tell us about how to classify phases of matter using tensor networks, also in one and two dimensions. Then in the afternoon, we'll have the real thing. And the real thing will be generalization. Frank Verstraete and Hugo Hegemann, they'll explain how to take the matrix product state, which is defined for a lattice, and extend it so that it applies to describe quantum field theories. Frank will explain the non-relativistic case, and then Jutta Hegemann will explain how to do relativistic theories. And after that, we'll have a discussion. The discussion is one of the goals of this workshop, that most of us are people coming from quantum information with some background also a little bit in condensed matter, but now we are moving towards applying these techniques to quantum field theories, and we would like to understand from the experts in quantum field theory, also get some feedback of, you know, in their opinion, what are the challenges, what type of problems we should be looking at next. All right, so that's Monday. And then on Tuesday, we'll have basically the same, a repetition of the program, but with another type of tensor network, that would be the MIRA. And so tomorrow morning, I'll give an introduction again to the MIRA, and we'll see applications of the MIRA on the lattice, in particular on the context of quantum critical systems, and that will be done by Glenn Edenbly. And we will also have Sansik Lee tell us about a closely related structure, which is this first principle construction of holographic duals that he's been working on. And then in the afternoon, again, we'll move to the continuum, and that will be done by Tobias Osborne and by Jutta Hegemann, again, for the non-relativistic case and for the relativistic case. And we'll end up again with a discussion. All right, so my job then here will be basically to introduce you today to matrix product states and PEPs, mostly matrix product states, and tomorrow to introduce you to the MIRA. I have a couple of announcements. The first one is that after the second talk this morning, that should be 11, I think, we'll have a picture taken that will be downstairs. So please, I'll tell you again about this after the second talk, but be ready for the picture. You know, go get, change your clothes and whatever. And tonight, after the discussion, there will be a workshop dinner. So some of you have already bought the tickets. I mean, you have to buy the ticket to participate, and I think that it might be too late to do that if you didn't do that so far, but yeah. Hey, Sebastian. And then the other thing is that Zhengchen's Gu's talk will be somewhere else. The third talk, I'll let you know once I understand where it's going to be. All right, so any questions so far? So let me start with the introduction. What I want to do is I want to go slowly through the basics of tensor networks. And the only goal here is to introduce you to the notation, and give you some basic properties of these tensor networks so that you have a better chance to follow the subsequent talks. And I'll be using both the slides and the Blackboard. So let me start with something basic. you see that we are using lots of, there are lots of drawings all the time. So let's try to first interpret these drawings. So the first thing I need to do is to introduce you to this diagrammatic notation that we often use. And what we are trying to represent here are simply tensors, arrays of complex coefficients. So if we have a vector is just an array of complex coefficients labeled by one index. And so what we're going to do is we're going to draw, instead of writing A, we're going to draw a circle. That means tensor and one leg, and that means one index. Okay. So naturally, if you see a tensor or a circle with two legs, what you have to think is that you are looking at the matrix. Okay. Each leg corresponds to an index of the matrix. And now we can iterate this. So if you see an object with three legs, so a circle with three legs, that corresponds to a tensor of rank three, three indices, and so on. All right? So in particular, typically, you'll make a calculation, and you'll see a complex structure. But at the end of the calculation, you'll find just a circle. What would that be? A number, right? So whenever you see a graph and you don't know what that is about, just look at how many open legs it has. If it has no open legs, that's a number. If it has one open leg, the whole structure has one open leg, that's a vector and so on. So that would be the basic objects. And now let's see at operations with these basic objects. So suppose that you have two matrices, R and S, and you multiply them. That's the normal way of writing this. That makes a lot of sense. We're used to it. But in order to generalize this matrix multiplication to tensor multiplication, it makes sense to use this other notation, the diagrammatical one. So that will be in components. And what we will do here is what you will find is two matrices, right? This, you can see two matrices here, a circle with two legs, another circle with two legs. And now the leg is shared, right? So whenever you see a leg shared between two circles, you have to think, OK, there is a sum over this index. That's right. You have this index has been contracted. So that will be our graphical representation of this very simple operation. Is that clear? So let me give you other examples. Suppose that you see this thing here. Count how many open legs you have. There are no open legs, right? So that has to be a number. And in particular, this number will correspond to taking, you see a vector, another vector. Oh, yeah, we have this. So this is a circle with just one leg. That's a vector. That is another vector. That's a matrix. And so when you see this, you have to think, OK, this is a complex number in general, which corresponds to taking a vector matrix vector. All right? So more of the same. Suppose that you have two tensors of rank 3, and you want to multiply them together to get a number. That's how we represent it. And so time for the exam, final test. You know, everybody's nervous. So what is this? OK. Fantastic. You passed the test. The rest can go. Yes. So that's now when you see something like this, you start thinking, OK, so I have a lot of tensors. They're multiplied together according to the indices that connect them. OK, that starts making sense. You see a number of open indices here. So even after multiplying all the tensors together, you have many indices open. That's going to be a wave function. OK. But we'll get there in a minute. So let me try to answer very.
How could I adjust the D so that the indices were in a different order?
So you would have, well, OK, so I'm not being careful enough here. So I'm just saying this should correspond to two rank three tensors connected in a given way. If I attach some particular meaning to this index and I want it to connect to this one, I would have to cross. Yeah, I would have to do it that way. All right, so let's try to answer the basic question, what's a tensor network? So the problem we are interested in here is in representing wave functions of many body systems. So suppose that you have n, that your system is composed of n sites, and each site is described by a d-dimensional vector space. Okay, so the total Hilbert space that you are interested in for the n sites is the tensor product of a d-dimensional space times a d-dimensional space, and so on, n times. So what we really want to do here is we want to talk about states, wave functions, of the system. And if we do this, we can always, given a wave function for this system, we can always expand it in a local basis, right? This will be a basis for the first system, a basis for the second, and so on. So this will be the more general expression. And this is the type of objects we would like to be able to deal with. But of course, we have a problem, namely that we have the number of coefficients here, the number of coefficients in this expansion is d, the local dimension, to the nth power, n being the size of the system. So for small n, that's OK. But if you consider large systems, the exponential growth of the number of coefficients that we have in the system size is going to be a very, very strong limiting how on the size of systems that we can deal in practice. All right? So by now, you should not be surprised about me drawing this instead of this tensor. Remember, this tensor here has n indices. So I will represent it with a circle with n legs. Yes? OK. So this is the object we want to talk about, but we cannot do that because it depends on too many parameters. So what we're going to do is we're going to use a tensor network. We want to represent some of the states that can be written in this way. So what we're going to do is we're going to replace this tensor. We're going to replace this tensor with a collection of tensors connected, interconnected, in such a way that the number of open indices matches the number of open indices we have. So each open index in this tensor network corresponds to one side of our system. OK? All right. So at this point, it might be worth trying to see in which sense we are representing a wave function. So for this, I'm going to use the blackboard. And I would swear I had chalk somewhere. Oh, in the box. Thanks. All right, so if we have a wave function, and I'm going to represent it with this I1, I2, IN indices. Now, what I would like, what I'm claiming is that I'm going to be working with some fancy structure which will have the same number of open indices, I1, I2, IN. And now, suppose that this is a spin 1/2 system, to give you an example. So in a spin 1/2 system, you could choose a configuration for these indices. Say the first index is up, up, down, up. Right? This would be a spin configuration for your system. Now, if you give me a spin configuration, the wave function will give you a complex number, the amplitude for that spin configuration. Right? So we can do this here. We can, but remember that if you have, say, a matrix, if you have a matrix with two indices, and you specify the value of one index, say, you have a matrix, columns, and rows, and you specify the value of one index, that's like specifying, say, a row, right? So you're left with a vector. So if you have an index and specify one index, sorry, if you have a tensor and you specify the value of one index, you end up with a tensor with one less index, right? So here you can see if we specify, this is our wave function, and if we specify the values of the indices, that amounts to removing the indices, and we just get a number corresponding to this amplitude. So we're going to do the same here. We're going to specify the values of these indices. This is going to be spin up, up, down, etc. And this up. And what you end up with, again, is a number, right? That there are no open indices anymore, right? And what we need to do now is we need to multiply these matrices together, these tensors together, to extract the value corresponding to that amplitude. OK? So this is in which sense we are making the replacement. If you specify a spin configuration, then you get a number out of this tensor network. For any spin configuration that you specify, you get a number. You get actually you get d to the n coefficients. You have d to the n possible spin configurations. Each one will give you an amplitude. All right? Is that clear? But the good news is that here, we needed to specify them directly. So we had d to the n coefficients that we needed to specify. And here, we could consider a tensor network made of order n tensors, right? Each tensor having a finite number of coefficients, a fixed number of coefficients, and then the total number of coefficients grows only as n if we do that. Okay, so this is a way of using a structure that depends only on n coefficients to specify d to the n coefficients.
Example of what could be inside that black box. And there could be lots of others to fill out the D to the N. Why is this particular choice the right one?
We'll have to justify that. I'm just saying that this is what we're going to do. Okay. Why will hopefully become clear later. But okay, so we have a systematic way of just by giving n order n coefficients, specifying the whole wave function in some restricted case. So more specifically, and that's going to be important, let's look at a typical tensor. And let's suppose that typically a tensor in our tensor network has p indices, and each index takes chi values. So imagine that this tensor network is made of tensors like this one with p indices, and each index goes from 1 to chi for some value chi. Then the total number of parameters of this tensor is chi to the p power. Right? We have p of those indices. Each one takes chi values. So in total, we have chi to the p different coefficients. And now suppose that we have n tensors. So the total number of coefficients that we have to specify in the tensor network grows linearly in n and at some power of chi. Okay, this chi being the number of different values each index takes. So what's happening here? The Hilbert space of our system is huge. It
chi is d.
Chi, no. D is the local dimension. Chi is some other parameter.
Okay.
Yeah. This is an approximate argument, right? So some of these tensors, it's true that one of the physical indices will have the values only. But let's just to make the argument, let's suppose that typically they have p values, p different indices, and each one takes chi values. So on this side, we have wave functions, generic k. So they cover all the Hilbert space. Okay. On the right, we have a very a much more restricted class of states that we can represent. So for instance, suppose that chi is equal to 1. So suppose that all these intermediate indices only take one value. That is like not having an index. Okay. So let's go back here. Let's go back here and see what happens if we build a tensor network, say this one, where the intermediate indices only take one value. Therefore, they don't exist. So I'm going to remove them. And what you are left with suddenly is a number. Okay, that's just a number, multiplying the rest of the structure, so say 5. And now what we have is a product of vectors. These are individual vectors. So this is the same as saying that your wave function for the whole system is equal to the wave function for the first side times the wave function for the second side, etc. Okay, so if we take chi equal to 1, we're not allowing for correlations between the different sides. What we're taking is a product state, and a completely an untangled state. And this is what you do typically when you use mean field theory. Okay? Yes, in mean field theory, you make a self-consistent approximation, assuming that there are no correlations between the first side. So you can understand a tensor network at zero order when value of chi is equal to 1. You can understand the tensor network as equivalent to mean field theory, which is indeed a very useful technique, which works in many cases, but it also fails in other cases because it does not account for correlations between the different parts of the system. So now what we could do is we could take chi equal to 2. And we would already cover a larger fraction of the Hilbert space. There will be more states that we can represent that go beyond mean field theory. And what we could do then is to keep increasing chi, and every time we do that, we account for more and more states. Okay? Now, if we wanted to cover the whole Hilbert space, then we would have to choose chi to be exponential in the system size. And that you can do it, and you see that indeed you recover the whole Hilbert space, but that's not interesting. That's not interesting because this tensor network will be computationally as expensive as the original state. What's interesting for us is when we can restrict the value of chi to say 4 or 100, but fixed, and then take and then look at the states that we get, and hopefully, or what's interesting is that sometimes they are a good representation of, say, the ground state of your system. You could consider a linear in n. So if it's linear in n, then it's still a, so if you put n here, it's a power law. So yeah. It doesn't have to be, in principle not, but in practice, so it would still be efficient. It would be a clear gain with respect to working with the whole Hilbert space. In practice, we tend to choose chi with a very small dependence on n. For critical systems, it may be log n, something like this. But, or, yeah. But in practice, we tend to even try to find tensor networks where chi does not need to scale with the system size. Alpha.
You said that alpha takes
chi,
then you will have basically integrations.
That's right.
So does it offer any advantage?
So this has been done in two contexts. One we won't talk about in this tensor, in this workshop, where you put a conformal field theory. You use a conformal field theory to describe the Bond indices. This has been done. The advantage of that is that indeed you can consider, well, it's a very, you can consider a lot of entanglement in your system. The disadvantage of that method is that a priori you fix what type of correlations to expect because you have to make a particular choice of conformal field theory that you'll use. So this is one context in which this has happened. Another context where this is happening is precisely the aim of the workshop, where your indices here will be labeling the continuum and each index will, for instance, correspond to a harmonic oscillator, so it will be infinite dimensional.
Yeah, even when I work with the lattice, in principle, I can introduce a tensor which I integrate over the rather than sum over.
Yes. This has been done. It's just that we won't talk about this here. Yeah. All right. So examples. Let's be more specific. So. Examples of tensor networks. The first example is the matrix product state, and some of you probably have seen a lot of it and even worked with it. So in this case, what we do is we're trying to represent, say, the ground state of a spin chain, a one-dimensional system. And what we do is we connect tensors according to a one-dimensional geometry that follows exactly the lattice, right? So for each side, you put a tensor, and then you have all these tensors for each side, and you connect them to nearest neighbors. And this is a tensor network that has been extremely useful. It has a long, long history. And it's basically the tool of choice if you want to understand the ground state of your lattice system, of your spin chain. You could use this. This is an extremely accurate representation in many situations. So this is the main tensor network we'll be talking about today. And we will see in the afternoon how to generalize this tensor network to the continuum for quantum field theories. Another possibility for one-dimensional systems is to use this other structure, the multiscale entanglement renormalization ansatz, or MIRA. And we'll be talking about this tomorrow. Okay, so just today, just let me notice that you're trying to represent the ground state of a one-dimensional system, a lattice, as before, and you use a tensor network in two dimensions. You extend it. And the extra direction corresponds to length scale in the system. So these tensor networks, there are other tensor networks for one-dimensional system, but we will discuss only these two in this workshop. In more than one dimension, you can generalize these structures. For instance, the next talk by Philippe Corboth will be about projected entangled pair states, or PEPs, where what you do is, following the idea of matrix product state, you connect your tensors for a two-dimensional lattice. You connect your tensors following, again, the geometry of the lattice. And so Philippe will tell us how, well, how this works when you try to simulate, to obtain the ground state of interacting fermions in two dimensions. And there are also generalizations of the mirror to larger dimensions. It's too tough to draw, so I didn't do it. Okay? So the tensor network formalism is very general. You can come up with your favorite tensor network. Here we'll be discussing those. And indeed, you can consider many different tensor networks, just get a bunch of tensors, connect them together. But it's important to keep in mind that not all tensor networks will be useful. Why is that? Well, let's have a look at what would make a tensor network useful. And I'll illustrate this with a particular example of the matrix product state. First thing is that what we were trying to do with the tensor network is to beat a computational difficulty. We have this big challenge. We have an exponentially exponential growth of coefficients with the system size. Now what we would like to do then is to use a tensor network to beat that. And the first thing we want of a tensor network is that it provides us with an efficient representation of many body wave functions. We want to only specify the wave function by giving, say, order n parameters only, not exponential n. So let me draw three examples. So suppose that we have n sites. And now I'm going to draw three examples of tensor networks. That's the first example. Another example would be to have a two-dimensional array of tensors. So this is I1, I2, IN. So this is N by N. And then finally, a third example would be the matrix product state. Okay. So let's see which one of these descriptions are efficient. The first one, is this one efficient? So the number of parameters, what's the scaling? Right, so if the local dimension is D, the number of parameters is D to the N. So it scales exponentially in the system size. So this is not going to be efficient. Okay, let's go to the next one. What about this one? So in this one, what we have, let's suppose that each tensor has a finite number of parameters, which is independent of the system size. So this is some number of parameters times the number of tensors, which is n, right? So this one is efficient. You give me order n parameters, and you have completely specified the wave function. Okay? So this is good. What about this one? Well, we just argued that this is also good. Again, actually, this was incorrect, right? You had n squared tensors. So that, but it's still, it's efficient. It's not exponential in n. It's polynomial. In this one, we would have order n parameters. Okay, so inefficient, efficient, efficient. Now, building, if you put a finite number of tensors or number of tensors that is proportional or polynomial in n, and each tensor has a small number of parameters, you have an efficient representation. But is this already useful? So we need to go to the next point. It's not enough to be able to specify the wave function. You have to be able to extract information from it. Okay. You don't care if somebody can specify a wave function with a small number of parameters. The question is, can we know how much is the expectation value of your favorite operator, say the magnetization? You want to be able to read physical information, extract physical information from the tensor network. So let's see how we compute expectation values. Okay? An expectation value of a local operator. So an expectation value says sigma z on site 4. Okay. Suppose that we want to compute this. Now let's write this as a tensor network. So this would be psi. Then the ket, the bra. On site 4, we put sigma z. It's a matrix, so two indices. And now the expectation value will be something like this. Wow, mismatch. So this is the expectation value we want to compute. Now, if we cannot compute this efficiently, our tensor network doesn't look too useful. Okay? So we had three examples. Clearly, this one, we cannot even efficiently represent the wave function, so it's not going to work. The number of operations you have to perform is exponential. Let's have a look at that one. So what I need to do is I need to write my wave function. This is psi. Now I need to write that was the ket. I'm now drawing the bra. And now I'm putting here site 4 is this one now. So that's my sigma z. It's the second site, but I just don't want to draw more. All right, so now this is the expectation value you would like to have. Now you have to tell me how I contract this to get the number that they want, okay? And it turns out that if you try to do that, the cost is exponential in the system size, okay? We don't know how to multiply these matrices to, so remember this is proportional to n, now this is 2n. If you try to contract this tensor network together, we don't have an efficient algorithm to do that. The cost is exponential in n, okay? So it was an efficient representation, but that doesn't mean that it's going to be useful. We cannot efficiently do that. So this one is also not useful. So let's have a look at why then the matrix product state is useful, or in which sense it is. So let's write the expectation value for the matrix product state. Again, that was sigma z 4 psi. So what I need to do is I need to write the MPS. On site 4, I put my sigma z. And now this is the tensor network that I need to contract this time. And the trick here is that there will be some cost associated to multiplying these two tensors together, these two tensors together, and these three tensors together. But this cost is independent of the system size, I mean, each individual contraction. And so there is a cost proportional to n, because I have to do it n times, that will bring my tensor network into this form, where now this index is double, corresponds to two indices before, but it doesn't matter. The important thing is that this, remember before we had a vector, a matrix, and a vector? So this is a generalization of that. What we have here is, you can read this as, I have a vector on the left, then I have a matrix, another matrix, P, Q, R, whatever, some number of matrices, and then a vector on the right. Right? So this type of multiplication, that's matrix multiplication, if this bond, this index here, so if this one was taking chi values, then this is just chi squared. It's some number. It's independent of the system size. And what we need to do in order to compute this expectation value is multiply some matrices together. The size of these matrices is independent of the system size, is independent of n. That's the key point. So all the computation is reduced to all the complexity of contracting this tensor network will scale as the complexity of multiplying matrices. We have order n multiplications, and each one will cost us some power of the bond dimension. But the important thing is this does not depend on n. this does not depend on n, or it's mild in n, the overall computational cost is efficient. It's not exponential in n anymore. Okay? So this is why the matrix product state is not only an efficient specification of your wave function, but actually a tensor network from which you can efficiently extract information. This one?
Yeah.
What's the question?
Does chi there depend on n? Why is it not efficient?
Why it's not efficient?
Yeah.
We don't know of any algorithm that would allow us to do that.
Are all the bonds the dimension chi?
I realize that you probably don't hear me because I don't hear you.
Are all the bonds of dimension chi?
Yeah, suppose that all the bonds are dimension chi. Now, the way you can contract this, for instance, is by multiplying this times this. Okay? So this will become a single tensor. Now you could multiply it times this. So now this is a single tensor. Now you keep progressing. What you see already is that the number of indices of your tensors are growing. Right? Now I multiply it, say, by this one. Okay, I do that. So I went from having two indices for this corner tensor, now it has four indices. Right? And if you keep doing that, what you realize is that the total number of indices that you will end up having in this tensor, in the most favorable case, is at least n. Or it grows with n. So that means that it's exponential. The cost is exponential in n.
And if you could contract such a tensor network, you could solve any sharp P problem, which is even much larger than NP complete than all these counting. So it's completely, so we cannot. I have some strong evidence that's impossible.
Was that useful, Peter? OK. Thanks for the question, then. All right, so the first, then we see that it's not enough to have an efficient description. It has to be, we have to be able to efficiently extract information. That's very important.
May I ask
you?
Yeah. So for the MPS case, what does chi depend on?
Sorry, again?
What does chi
Right. So this chi will tell you how much entanglement you can encode in your wave function, how much entanglement your wave function can carry. So if you want to study a highly entangled ground state, chi will have to be large. If you want to study a state with no entanglement, say a product state, chi can be equal to 1. So it gives you an idea of, right, it's related to how entangled your wave function is. All right, so this immediately tells you that the cost of your simulations will depend on how entangled your system is. All right, so, and now the big question, why do we care about, I mean, having an efficient scheme to multiply numbers, that's not so exciting unless you know that this tensor network offers an accurate representation of the type of states you would like to describe. So in general, we may not have, if you want to represent some state, we may not have a tensor network that can do that efficiently. Okay? But it so happens that there is an important class of states in our many-body systems that can be efficiently represented with tensor networks. And this is not limited to ground states, but let's focus on ground states. So what happens is ground states of local Hamiltonians quite often can be very accurately approximated by a tensor network state. Okay? So you can use a tensor network state in the number of proofs. I mean, this is a statement that let's say that the theoretical understanding of why this is the case is way behind experience. So we've been using these techniques, say, in the MRG since 1992 to represent ground states of spin chains without really understanding why or having a theorem that says that we can do that. But it's been done for the last 20 years. Okay, so there is a lot of accumulated numerical experience that tells you that if you want to represent the ground state of a spin chain, then the MPS is going to do it for you. Okay, it will offer an efficient representation of your ground state. So let's try, I won't show any proof here, but let's try to get some intuition of why this is the case. And so what we can do is we can look at entanglement in ground states on the one hand, and also correlations in ground states of spin chains, how correlations decay, how entanglement scales. And we can look also at how entanglement and correlations behave in a matrix product state. And we'll see a nice match. Okay, and this will be, if you want some, you can use it to build intuition of why a matrix product state is a good representation for ground states of spin chains. So let's do that. Let's look at correlations and entanglement in a matrix product state. But before that, of course, let me remind you of how, of what to expect. Suppose you have a local Hamiltonian on a spin chain. This could be your favorite, I don't know, Ising model, quantum Ising model with a transverse magnetic field. So suppose that your system is gapped, right? There is, when you take the thermodynamic limit, suppose that you have a finite difference in energy between the ground state energy and the first excited state. And then, in general, there are general statements you can make about, or you, general properties you would expect from the ground state in this case. So the first one is that correlations decay exponentially. So if you have a two-point correlator between positions x1 and x2, these are two positions in your spin chain, by measuring some observable a1 or some local operator a1 and b2, a and b on positions x1 and x2, so you have this two-point correlator and you look at how it scales when the Hamiltonian is gapped, this will typically decay exponentially with distance. That's something you know well. Right, there will be some typical correlation length, which will depend on the gap, and so on. But the important thing is these correlators decay exponentially with the distance. That's a typical behavior you expect. And second, we will also expect saturation of entanglement entropy. So what does this mean? Let's take, again, the ground state of the gap system of a spin chain. You can imagine that the spin chain is infinite. And then you could trace out most of the spins and just look at the reduced density matrix for a region A, right? So that's a finite region of your spin chain. The whole system is in a pure state, in the ground state, but if you trace out all those spins outside region A, you end up with a mixed state, typically, a density matrix. And now what we want to do is we want to look at the entropy, of this mixed state. And the entropy of this mixed state will tell us about how entangled this block of spins is with the rest of the system. If there was no entanglement between the block of spins and the rest of the system, we would have a pure state also inside, and the entropy would be zero. So every time you see that the entropy is non-zero, it's telling you that there are correlations between inside the block and outside the block, and that the state is entangled. And so what you could ask now is, how does this quantity, the entropy, scale with the size of the block? And in principle, for instance, well, yeah, that's the question we want to answer. We want to look at how this entropy scales as we consider larger and larger blocks of spins. Remember, the whole system is infinite. We're just looking at finite region. And it turns out that if the system is gapped in one dimension, you expect that this entropy might grow with the system size until it saturates. So the entropy reaches some maximum value as you increase the block size, and it stays like that. Okay, so a typical situation. Then would be, if you plot the entropy as the size of the block, that this is the entropy. A typical situation would be that as you, so for, say, a smallest block would be one spin, two spins, L spins in general, that the entropy grows, but after some distance, it gets saturated. That's what we see in practice, if you look at ground states of gap systems in 1D. And typically, this will happen, as you expect, when you reach the correlation length in the system. All right, so these are two properties that we see in gap systems. The ground state of gap systems in 1D fulfill these two properties. And now, I would like to use the last minutes to argue that matrix product state actually also fulfills these two properties. So this makes it more plausible that the matrix product state is a natural description of ground states in 1D for gap systems. Okay, is that clear? So let me do that. First, I need to justify that the asymptotic decay of correlations in a matrix product state will follow an exponential law. And I'm going to use, again, the blackboard. So what do I want to see? What we have here is, I said A measured on x1, B measured on x2. This is the type of correlation we want to consider. And now I'm going to write a tensor network expression, a tensor network for this expression. So again, first I'm going to draw the MPS for the first side for the ket. Now I'm going to put, this is x1. This is x2, so this corresponds to A and B. And now I close this. With the tensor network that corresponds to the bra, okay? So this is the number that I want to compute, okay? This is the number that I want to compute. And I've told you how to do this, matrix multiplications, blah, blah, blah. Now, I want to argue the following, except for, so I can do some operations here, right? And get rid of this and replace it with some other matrix. So this is operationally, that's what I would do. But this is the type of expression that I want to analyze. And remember, this is x1 and this is x2. So this length here is x1 minus x2. That's the distance that we have. All right, so if I try to do that, what do I need to do? Well, I can multiply these two together, and these two together. And I can view this, and I could also multiply these guys together, and I end up with an expression that is similar to what we discussed before. It's just, so suppose that A was here, B was here. What I have is some matrix that I have to, assuming that your system is translation invariant, I can use these tensors to be identical. So this matrix appears here. Many times? How many times? So m times a number, which is x1 minus x2, roughly. Okay? So this is the distance between the sides. And so I'm trying to compute something like this. A vector on the left, on the right, a vector on the left, and x1 minus x2 powers of M, okay? So now it just follows from here that for large distances, so let me introduce L equal to x1 minus x2, just to simplify the notation. So I'm trying to compute this object. Now, for large L, I can look at the eigenvalue decomposition of M, and so what I have is that this object is going to scale as the some eigenvalue of m to the nth power. Okay, so you can see already that this is an exponential decay of correlations. It decays exponentially with L. It's some eigenvalue to the nth power. Okay, but right. So in order to give more. Right, that's a good question. So why is this eigenvalue smaller than 1, right? I should argue this. Well, this has to do with the fact that you want to normalize. So you would have to normalize this let's put it this way. If your state is already normalized, that happens to imply that this eigenvalue is going to be smaller than 1, okay? It's a normalization issue. All right, so we see this. Physically, we find the gap ground states of gap systems in 1D. have polynomial decay of correlations. Matrix product state is reproducing that naturally. And the second thing we have to see is that the entanglement entropy saturates. We want to see this saturation of the entanglement entropy as you consider larger and larger blocks. Okay? But this is, again, easy to argue. It so happens that in a matrix product state, let's have a look at, say, the entropy for half of the system. So between this part and that part. What you see is that this wave function, psi, you have built it by connecting. Here you have an index that takes chi values. There are chi values for this index. And we've built this wave function by connecting chi different options here with chi different options on the other side. So if I look at the reduced density matrix, if I call this now A and this is B, if I look at the reduced density matrix for par A, it's made of chi different pieces. So the reduced density matrix, at most, can have rank chi. If I diagonalize it, what that means is that if I diagonalize it, I get a diagonal matrix where there are only chi different values that are different from 0, and the rest must be 0. Okay, the rank of row A is at most chi. So having a finite bond dimension here with chi values implies that the rank of the reduced density matrix is at most chi. There are at most chi eigenvalues that are non-zero. So what that implies is that the entropy of this density matrix in the most mixed case would be having that all these eigenvalues are 1 over chi. And the entropy of that is equal, one can see that it's equal to log chi, scales as log chi. Okay? So finite bond dimension implies that any reduced density matrix that you can consider coming from your MPS has at most this entropy, log chi. All right? So this again matches the expectation that the entropy should saturate. Right? This is what happens in ground states of gap systems in 1D. And the MPS, again, matches this expectation. It's bounded. Right. No. I just wanted to give you, the flavor of how this works. So in practice, you see that it follows this shape. But indeed, I didn't. It's reached exponentially fast in the distance, but it's, yeah, right. Okay, so that's what, so I gave you, I didn't prove that ground states of gap systems in one dimension can be approximated with a matrix product state, but I show you that matrix product states naturally fulfill two properties that you see in ground states of one-dimensional systems, right? So this makes it plausible that the matrix product state is a good representation for these ground states. And then you can invoke numerical evidence, overwhelming numerical evidence from the last 20 years, which, so if you know about DMRG, the density matrix renormalization group, it's based on using a matrix product state to represent the ground state of gap systems, and it's just overwhelming, okay? The numerical evidence. It's a good, very good method. So this is how far I wanted to go with this introduction. So the same can be argued, then similar things can, we can argue similarly about the PEPs for two-dimensional systems. There is also a match between the expectation of how the entropy should grow in a system in two dimensions and how it grows in PEPs, at least for a large class of ground states, and the same for MIRA and so on. All right, so this is the summary. I wanted to introduce the diagrammatic notation that most of the speakers afterwards will be using. I tried to clarify what's a tensor network, gave you some examples, and I tried to argue when a tensor network might be useful. So the big recent development that motivated organizing this workshop is that these tensor networks that are defined for lattice systems have now been extended to quantum field theories. And this was proposed in two papers, first for matrix product state by Frank Verstraete and Ignacio Sirac, and the second for continuous meta by Jutta Hegemann, Tobias Osborne, Henry Verschelde, and Frank Verstraete. And well, I think we're very lucky that we have most of these people here, and they are going to be the ones who introduce us to the quantum field theory version of these tensor networks. So let me finish then again by remind you of how the rest of the workshop is going to be. So as I said, today we are going to look at MPS and PEPS, a class of tensor networks. And tomorrow we'll look at MERA, another class. And what I thought was important is to really convince you first that these methods are powerful, at least on the lattice. That's where we have most evidence, right? So, and this is why we'll have, for the rest of morning, two talks where we'll see the most powerful applications of this method on the lattice to fermions and to determining phases of matter. And only in the afternoon we'll look at the continuum. So that's all for the introduction. And there is nobody chairing the session, so if you have questions.
In the sense of variational theory, suppose I'm given a Hamiltonian, I want to find the ground state, then you have to, given this matrix product answer, you have to find out these matrix elements, that is all the matrices.
Yes.
So how do you, in practice, is it like a variational thing that is, you try various matrix elements, and then find out.
Right, so
you give an answer for the matrix form.
So in the end, this is a variational ansatz. It defines a subset of all the states in the Hilbert space. And you want to use this variational ansatz to approximate the ground state of your Hamiltonian. And all the variational coefficients, the ones that you can change, are the coefficients of these matrices or these tensors, right? So a way you could use to find a good approximation to the ground state or to try to minimize the energy is the energy is a sum of local operators, right? The Hamiltonian is the sum of local terms. And I've shown you with the MPS that if you have, say, a one-side operator, you have an efficient way of contracting the tensor network and obtaining the expectation value, right? So I can use this technique. I can now, you give me a Hamiltonian, which is made of local terms, say I plus one, nearest neighbors, as an example, for your spin chain. And you have that this is the state, the variational wave function. Now, a typical term will be acting here. And you know how to compute the expectation value for this term. Right, that would be the expectation value.
So
for
H.
Sorry.
Final form of the matrix.
Yes.
After you optimize, see, I'm trying to compare it with standard variational approach.
Right.
Where you see the physics in the form of the wave functions, like in Jastrow function.
That's right.
Or in Harmonic wave function. Here, it's in some abstract matrix, and can one see the functional form of the matrix at the end of
the data. So, in general, you cannot just look at the matrix and understand the physics. You can understand the symmetries of the problem. There is quite some information that you can already see from the matrix. But if you want the physics, you have to compute expectation values.
So that is in contrast to standard variational approach. You can often see the physics.
Right, but I would argue that in standard variational approach, you put in the physics in your variational ansatz, and you're just trying to see how low the energy gets. But the physics that you extract are practically the physics that you put in from the start, right? So the difference here is that if you use a matrix product state, practically all you are doing is restricting your attention to states that have exponential decay of correlations asymptotically, and bonded entanglement entropy. So this still gives you a very large, so there are many different physical situations or regimes that correspond to that, right? So This is not just ferromagnetism or antiferromagnetism, or I don't know. You could have topological order. You would expect many, many different things. These same answers can account for all of those, right? So if you really want to read the physics out of the answers after the variational optimization, then you need to go and ask physical questions and compute the answer for this physical question. So you can ask, are there oscillations in the correlators? Just compute it, and you will get the answer that you want. But I would look at, I take this as something very positive from tensor networks. They are not as biased towards specific physics as a typical variational approach, where your wave function is already antiferromagnetic or favors some type of order from the start, right? So here we don't do that. Therefore, it's harder to read from looking at the matrices what type of order we obtain in the end. But you have the whole wave function, so just ask the relevant question in terms of this wave function, make a computation, and you'll get the answer.
So computer helps.
Oh, you need the
Without
computer.
Without computer, this would not happen. All these insects.
That's roughly true. So if you have symmetries, you might be able to see them from the tensors. But that's all.
Yeah, I was wondering, how are these simpler tensor networks distributed over the original Hopkins space? Are they evenly distributed so that you can imagine it some?
No, so if you pick up a random state in a Hilbert space for one dimension, you have a chain spins and you pick up a random state with probability arbitrarily close to one, it will have as much entropy as possible for any region. And these guys have limited entropy. So this tells you that they are really not representative of the, they are a little corner there. They are sitting there. They are very concrete, very specific. But luckily enough, it turns out that typical ground states are also in that corner. So, yeah. Okay, so if there are no more questions, then we'll move on.